Hello and welcome to the Rest is History bonus episode, and a special welcome to all of you who've signed up in the last few weeks and all of you who've signed up through Apple. Tom, it's great to have more people on board, isn't it? We have a great crew. We're in the middle of recording a series about Columbus at the moment, so we're full of nautical metaphors, but we could always do with more able seamen.
And I think that people who may have listened to us talk about nautical matters in earlier episodes will frankly be astounded at the Patrick O'Brien-esque levels of nautical knowledge that both of us display.
Yeah.
Dominic's knowledge of sails and rigging, my knowledge of winds.
Yeah.
Before you know it, we'll be discoursing on rope. Actually, Dominic, I should just say I'm halfway through the second Patrick O'Brien novel.
How are you finding it?
Loving it.
Are you?
Really loving it. Yeah. So when I finish this, I'm going to read it for the rest of the afternoon.
Oh, my words. You're living the life of Riley, aren't you?
Yeah, I know.
Jolly. And you've also, Tom, been buying historical artifacts, because I read on our notes sent by the producers that you have bought a coin minted in 15 BC by Tasciavanus, the father of Cunobelinus, the king of the Catavellauni and founder of St. Albans. Is that correct? Is this true?
It's absolutely correct. It's so I have a dealer.
It's
all very county lines. He kind of occasionally pushes me things. And it was very well timed on his part, because I've been hankering after a mammoth bone.
Right.
So my agent briefly shared an office in Soho with a guy who was an early collector of young British artists. So Rachel Wright-Ridd and Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin, all that kind of crew, and had done very well out of it. And he was a great collector. And among all the various objects that he'd bought was a large mammoth bone, a thigh bone. So I've been kind of wondering whether to buy it or not. And I'm waiting on the report of a paleontologist as to what the provenance of this bone might be, you know, what its condition, its value, all that kind of stuff. So anyway, so I was kind of gearing up perhaps to invest in something exciting like that. And then this other guy who's sold me lots of coins in the past said that he'd got this amazing... It is an amazing coin, because it has on it, well, first of all, it has the head of Tasciavanus, who's the grandfather of Caratacus.
Okay.
You know, fought the Emperor Claudius. But there's it's a two-headed one, so you can see him in profile, and then there's another one. I'll put a photo up on the Discord for this. But you can see another one behind it. And the theory is that this is one of his sub-kings. But the thing that's brilliant about it is that you have these words ver on it, which is Verlaemion.
That's St. Albans.
So Verulanium, which will then become St. Albans. Verulanium, Roman city,
yeah,
founded on the site of this this town, presumably founded by Tasciavanus. So this is probably the earliest written mention of a place name in Britain, produced in Britain.
Crikey.
Which is quite something, isn't it?
Yeah, that is quite something.
So,
and hold on, they're writing that in Latin.
They're writing it in Latin script, yeah.
So that's 15 BC. So Latin has already, because there's so many links between Britannia, what becomes Britannia, and Gaul.
Yeah, well, the very usage of coins is reflective of Roman influence.
Yes. We've never done the Roman conquest of Britain, Tom.
Yeah, we should do that.
So the producers say to me, as a materialist historian, do I not collect dinosaur bones or coins? I do have some coins, actually. I've got some Byzantine coins.
Do you?
I do.
When did you get them?
About 3 or 4 years ago.
And which period?
Heraclean.
Oh, right.
Because I find that quite interesting, the sort of descent into the abyss kind of.
Yeah.
There's one with Heraclius and his sons.
Looking straight on.
Yes, exactly. So they've moved from the profile.
Yeah.
So a tiny bit earlier, I think, that they changed from the Roman profile to looking straight on, which is obviously often seen as the moment of transition from the classical to the early medieval, from late antique to early medieval or something. But do I have other things? I've got a few kind of, to be honest, most of the historical memorabilia I have is stuff that I was given for TV series.
Right.
And then the producers just wanted to get rid of. They didn't want it anymore. So they'd sort of say.
So from a modern.
Yeah, modern. So there'd be sort of old copies of The Sun or something.
Oh, right.
So my house is full of old copies of tabloid newspapers. When I was doing my PhD, which was on Eugene McCarthy, who ran for president in 1968, I was given a load of Eugene McCarthy memorabilia from his presidential campaign.
Eugene for president.
Yeah, all this sort of stuff. And you know what, Tom? I actually just threw it out into a skip eventually.
Oh.
Why?
Why?
Well, I had so much of it. I remember my wife said to me at one point, why have you got 100 Eugene McCarthy matchboxes?
But you must have a badge. Didn't you keep a badge?
I've probably kept a badge. Yeah, I've got a badge. But actually, even the badges, I was kind of banned from exhibiting.
So if you go to America and you wear a Eugene McCarthy badge.
Like-minded people will perhaps go and shake you by the
hand. Tell me about the kind of people that would, you'd go, good on you, sir.
What kind of people? They would be poets. They would be high-minded, earnest, anti-Vietnam War, people of a certain age, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Very much my kind of people, Tom.
Your kind of people. You go to Starbucks and...
Definitely my constituency.
Yeah.
I used to have tons of posters and badges of presidential candidates, you know, loads of them. And I used to collect the obscure ones. So people who had run for the Democratic nomination in...
So when did they begin?
When did they begin? 19th century.
Did Lincoln... put out badges?
Oh, they would undoubtedly have had what would they have had? Adam Smith would be a great man for this. They might have had sashes, things like that, in the mid-19th century.
What's the earliest piece of memorabilia from a presidential campaign you've got?
Oh, my. What do I? Oh, very, very, very recent, Tom, because I had no interest in pre-50s politics.
Well.
So it would probably be Nixon. I've got some Nixon stuff somewhere buried away.
Oh, I think you should get your Nixon stuff out and put a photo of it on the Discord.
We like Dick, that kind of thing. I mean, the slogan that Nixon, that people, the sort of, the one that is sort of regarded as, you know, the sort of bootleg that people crave, but I don't believe ever really existed, were badges that said, you can't lick our dick. But I don't think they were ever produced. I'm skeptical about the truth of those claims. But anyway, you didn't expect to hear me saying that on the rest of this history.
No. Well, that's something to look forward to. And if there's anyone out there with a, what is it?
You can't lick our dick.
You can't lick our dick. Badge and get it, put it on the Discord. It'd be great to see.
Yeah.
Right. So what have we been doing? So we've just done two episodes on Columbus, haven't we? And this was absolutely, this was classic because the plan originally was to do one episode. Then it got expanded to two. Then over the weekend, you messaged me to say, I think it's going to be four. And I tried to barter you down to three.
I wasn't having it.
But no, it's four.
It is four.
It's four. So it's going to be four episodes. And I have to say, Dominic, that you were absolutely right. And I was wrong.
Oh, good.
Well, I like to put my hand up when, when I got things wrong, because it is a brilliant story. I mean, the inherent drama of it is a great story. And it's a story that can sustain that weight, I think. Because the two previous four, no, we've done three, haven't we? We've done the Falklands, which is maybe an outrider, but we've done the American Civil War and the rise of the Nazis. Those are, I mean, heavyweight subjects.
There is another four, Tom, that you've forgotten, which you desperately fought against, which was Portugal.
Of course, we did Portugal as well. Okay, so Age of Exploration, you know, explorers. It's something about explorers. Maybe it's the expansiveness of it. I don't know. Anyway,
I think sometimes you and I like doing more when it's subjects that we actually don't know as much about, because the voyage of discovery, as it were, is such fun, don't you think?
Well, there's a question from Sam who's asking, do you prefer going over a subject that you know so well? And the honest, I think we've discussed this before. The honest answer is actually, no, I don't. Partly because you're reheating, you know, old dinner.
Yeah.
But also because people expect you to know it. And so you're much more tense about getting things wrong.
Yeah. Whereas we've always got an excuse on Columbus that we're not experts.
But also it's exciting to kind of explore something
it is
that's relatively new.
It reminds me of when I was a student, and the way it worked at Oxford was that you would do a different subject every week and have to write an essay on it, passing yourself as an expert. I mean, this is the criticism that people have of the Oxbridge education. So one week, you know, it would be the origins of Islam, and the next week it would be something pretty much completely different. You know, you'd be given the reading list by the tutor at the end of your tutorial, and he'd sort of say, well, I'll see you a week today. But I used to love that. I used to love looking at the reading list and thinking, I'm now going to explore a subject that I previously knew nothing at all about.
But Dominic, I mean, I think there is a difference there, because the subjects that I like doing are ones that I do know a bit about. I know enough about to know where I've got to look for the interesting stuff. Or they're subjects that I've written about before and didn't have time to kind of go into, subjects that I would like to know better. Because the thing is that it's like writing an essay. The reason you have to write an essay is that it gets it, you know, it imposes it on your brain much, much more clearly. And having to kind of sketch out a plan, knowing that you're going to talk about it, you know about it in a way that you don't just reading a book.
Because also you're working out what matters. aren't you? You're putting it into order. Yeah.
Yeah. As you're talking, ideas will come to you. You know, if I'm talking about Caesar, the likelihood that I'm going to have a new insight is low because I've written about it so much and thought about it so much. But Columbus, I'm fizzing with great insights, yeah. as you will all hear, my incredible insights into...
All your insight into wind. You talk a lot about the wind. Absolutely. In a way that...
I'm all over it.
Yeah.
Don't you think? I mean, I think it's a kind of sweet... There's a sweet spot between... I mean, total ignorance. There are subjects that we haven't... You know, people say, why don't you do this subject? The simple answer is, I know nothing about it.
The Costa Rican Civil War.
No, because that's manageable. Yeah. So there's one that I'm always being asked about, and both of us are, which is the suffragettes, because it's such an obvious subject. I know nothing about the suffragettes. I mean, I kind of know about the most basic outline, but not enough that I would have to really, really read a lot before I felt capable of talking about it with any degree of pretense at authority. But Columbus, I mean, I wrote about Columbus in Dominion, not in any great detail, but you can tell what I was looking for.
Yes.
And I duly found it. But Dominic, I mean, back me up here. Columbus, so there's a lot of Christianity in Columbus.
There is. Yeah, no, there is. If you miss the Christianity, there's a book. Have you read this book? I'm sure we've mentioned it a few times in the podcast, called Conquistadores by Fernando Cervantes.
Yes, I have.
So, I mean, his big argument, which I found very interesting, was that he's a Mexican historian who's based in Britain. He's clearly very irritated with a lot of the debates about Columbus and the conquistadors. He thinks they trade in caricatures of the Spanish conquistadors, and he thinks that so many of these sort of popular accounts miss the genuine religious motivations that all these people had.
Music to my ears.
In fact, our producer, Theo, is also a big fan because he has posted a comment in the chat. Brilliant academic. We don't normally get that sort of instant feedback from Theo about the academic credentials of people he mentioned. So it's very good to see. It's a good trend. Now, talking of subjects that you probably have talked about a lot, but I think this is a really interesting thing. There's a great discussion going on the Discord. So that's our chat. For those people who don't know, that's the chat for the members of the Rest is History Club. About the Roman Empire and its center of gravity, Western or Eastern. So Ethelfrith says, was the Roman Empire essentially, is it fair to say it's a Middle Eastern entity with a large and poor Western European appendage? Is that, that's too strong, isn't it, Tom?
Economically, that is much too strong. I mean, you could make that case culturally, perhaps, but not economically. Spain, for instance, is an absolutely key possession for the Roman emperors because of the mines.
Yes.
And the scale of the mining in Spain is so enormous that they even notice it in Judea. So it's in the Book of the Maccabees. They talk about how the wonder of the scale of the Roman mining exploits. And North Africa is one of the great bread baskets of the Mediterranean, along with Egypt. So incredibly important possession. And Gaul is very, very prosperous. And southern Britain, lowland Britain as well. So these are all economically very vibrant. And even after the collapse of the Western Empire, the northern reaches of Gaul remain very, very wealthy.
But Tom, if we were to divide up the Roman Empire between ourselves, you'd want to make your play for the East, wouldn't you, rather than the West, do you think?
Well, if you look at it, during the first century BC, so the period covered by the Ides of March episodes that we put out, there are three civil wars. Pompey retreats to Greece. The liberators, Brutus and Cassius, retreat to Greece. Antony and Cleopatra retreat to the east and make their stand in Greece. All of them get defeated. In every case, it's the guy who holds the West who wins.
But that said, when the Roman Empire is formally divided, it's the eastern section that survives much longer than the western.
Yes, I think that is because... in part because there are more natural divisions between the various segments of the Western Empire. So there's the Channel, Pyrenees, the Alps, and then the Straits of Gibraltar.
So more easily fragmented, you think?
So it's more easily fragmented. So what dooms the Western Empire is the fact that the kind of the sinews that have held those various constituent parts together get severed. And that's why historically, I think Western Europe has never really been united since, is that it's very difficult to cohere.
Yeah.
Much more difficult to cohere than the East.
Joe, I was reading a book over the weekend, or idly looking at a book that I was given for Christmas called The Emperors of Byzantium, published by Thames and Hudson. Very nice kind of coffee table book about Byzantine emperors. that came out for Christmas. And bizarrely, it was being written by the controller of ITV.
Really?
Yeah, Kevin Ligo. Oh,
that is unexpected.
With a foreword by Robert Peston.
Just, when did this come out?
And an endorsement from Doctor Who showrunner Russell T. Davis.
Brilliant.
It's very strange. It's a beautiful book. It's a beautifully illustrated coffee table
book. Is it good?
It is pretty good. I mean, it's sort of pen portraits of all the emperors in a quite a sort of John Julius Norwich-y kind of way.
Nothing wrong with that.
But there's nothing wrong with that. And it's very enjoyable. So if people are interested in the Byzantine emperors and they want a sort of introduction, there's just a sort of jolly canter with most gorgeous illustrations.
But it's never jolly, is it?
Oh, it is. So much castration, eye gouging.
Oh, no, but you know where it's leading.
Well, I suppose you do know where it's leading. But I mean, the idea that it's... Well, the sort of classic idea of the Eastern Roman Empire, Byzantine Empire, that it's doomed from the beginning. I mean, it lasts for, four times longer than the United States has existed. I mean, that's not really doomed to my mind. Okay, let's talk about the Cathars. This was a veritable tour de force by you, Tom. And I want to kick off the many questions with one from John Andrews. So John Andrews says, we hinted at this, but he wants to know how much the memory of it fed into the strength of French Protestantism, which was very strong in the 16th and 17th centuries. So to what extent was there a continuity between Catharism, insofar as Catharism existed, and Huguenotism, if that's a word?
I don't know. It's a simple answer.
Oh, crikey.
What I do know is that Huguenots were very interested in, let's call them Cathars. They certainly collected documents that seemed to show what the Cathars believed and may well have faked them. So I think I mentioned in one of the episodes that there were these documents were found that seemed to come from, say, the mid 13th century. And these are ones that talk about the dualism and all the kind of stuff that, then feeds into the popular image of who and what the Cathars were. And there's much debate as to whether these are genuine or whether they were faked by Protestants. But either way, it's clear that Protestants were aware of this heretical tradition and interested in it. But I don't know whether there was any direct line there.
Yeah.
I would have thought not.
Didn't you have a point that you made that one of the first scholars, a man called Schmidt or something like that, was a Protestant?
Yes.
And that would explain the interest in taking the Cathars seriously?
Yeah, so one of the questions that hangs over this whole thing is why people have been so ready to believe the story about, you know, that there was a Cathar church and all that kind of stuff. And again, I think I may have mentioned in the episode that in a way, powerful myths work when both sides have a stake in them.
Yeah.
So for the Dominicans, and by extension, the Catholic Church, as it comes to be defined after the Reformation, the idea of this kind of heritage of fighting heresy, the Cathars show that heresy is a real monstrous threat, you know, that these are people who believe truly by Orthodox standards, monstrous things. And so therefore the Church can cast itself as properly the defender of Christ's truth against the Hydra head of heresy. So it's a useful story to tell in the context of Protestantism. Likewise, for Protestants, it enables them to cast the Catholics as monstrous bigots who are burning everybody left, right, and center. And this in turn then feeds into, as Protestant anti-popery so often does, feeds into the myths that atheists and people who would define themselves as against religion full stop.
Yeah.
They also have something for it. You know, and this is obviously what Dan Brown is picking up on and Kate Moss and people who have...
Well, Dan Brown himself, I believe, says that he used to be religious but has since found atheism.
Yes.
And you can see why that trajectory would explain that. We'll come on to the Da Vinci Code itself in a second. So you mentioned the Dominicans. Kukos would like more stuff about the Dominicans. Kukos says he or she wants an episode on medieval friars, comparing the Dominicans with the Franciscans, for example. So there's also the Carmelites, the Cistercians, and so on. I don't really understand all these definitions.
Well,
Your favourite?
The Franciscans, who feature very heavily in...
Talking to birds or something.
Yes, exactly. It's the whole talking to birds thing. The thing that's fascinating about the Franciscans, and this very much touches on the Albigensians as well, and it's going on at pretty much the same time, is that Francis could very easily have been burnt as a heretic.
Right.
So the Franciscans walk the tightrope again and again in this period. The question of who is a heretic and who comes to be celebrated as a saint, you know, the dividing line is very, very narrow. And that's why the Franciscans are so interesting and the figure of Francis is so interesting. And their ability to inspire people is evident in the story of Columbus, which we've just been doing in the two episodes we've just been recording. So I think the Franciscans would be great. And Francis is a kind of box office medieval name, isn't he?
I suppose, yeah.
You'd allow me to do that, to do St. Francis? You think it's sufficiently interesting?
How would we sell that, Tom? What would the title be?
He talked to the birds.
Against sex and violence.
No sex or violence.
Yeah. Yeah. He talked to birds. That's the title.
The medieval Dr. Doolittle.
Exactly. Yeah. And there you go. That's it. That's what we're calling it, the medieval Dr. Doolittle. Okay, now, we had a few questions about the Da Vinci Code. We had an absolutely disgraceful comment. Have you seen this by Rosa?
Yeah. I'll read this. I love that the man of the people versus the faux intellectual's mask slipped so fast when it came to taking the mickey out of a popular novel. Yeah. Very true. How do you plead to that?
I responded to that vigorously. As it's, the producers have written in the document, Dominic seemed to disagree with this strongly. I do disagree with that because just because something is temporarily popular doesn't make it good. So we've talked about a lot of popular, as it were, middlebrow, indeed lowbrow things. We did Game of Thrones. We did superheroes. We did Agatha Christie. We did Tolkien. All of those have great longevity, and I think it would be foolish for anybody to doubt that those have a great
holding power.
Yeah, they have power and resonance. The Da Vinci Code clearly has a kind of resonance and a power because it touches on all these conspiracy theories.
But also, Dominic, because it is very, very page-turnable. And I think the problem was that you came to it already knowing everything Maybe. About it. So the whole thing seemed ridiculous. So there was nothing about the plot that in any way could hold your attention.
But Tom,
I knew all that stuff. I mean, I'd read the Holy Blood and Holy Grail back in the mists. And when I read it, I could feel that this was bad. It was like eating a very unhealthy burger.
Right.
I knew it was bad for me, but I couldn't help myself.
But that's fine. But then you don't deny afterwards that kebab van burger is bad. So the point about the Da Vinci Code is what makes it different from Agatha Christie or J.R.R. Tolkien, which you've done. And what also makes it different things I've written about, like, let's say, I'm just looking at my shelves. So, for example, I did a chapter about Catherine Cookson, the sort of misery, northeastern working class, miserable lives.
Clogs.
Working class lives, clogs, people in clogs with illegitimate children.
Shawls.
Sort of sagas in the north. They are not, on a sentence level, badly written. I mean, they're boring. They might be blandly or boringly written, but they're not badly written. Dan Brown seems to me, and to a lot of other critics, to be positively badly written. Now, I would say equate him with Geoffrey Archer. Not Agatha Christie. And the thing that he has in common with Geoffrey Archer is I don't believe that people buy Geoffrey Archer's books.
They buy it for the plot.
But I don't think they still buy them for the plot. I think they're been and gone. I think that's the case with the Da Vinci Code. So I don't think in 50 years' time people will be downloading that podcast.
Yeah, I'm not denying that. But it is very readable. It was very readable.
Okay. Anyway, I don't think this is the man of the people mask. I think
But it was a weird thing that every time I looked at the Discord, there'd be another 4,000 comments on the Cathars.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, brilliant, the enthusiasm for medieval history. But I think a lot of it was about Dan Brown. But there was also, I should just say, so there were various comments on the state of play in the academic field on this. That it is, you know, there are still people who are holding out for the idea that there really was a dualist church and there, you know, really was brought to the south of France by the Bogomils and all this kind of stuff. I just don't see it. It, as I said in the episode, it seems a posh equivalent of the Holy Blood and Holy Grail because it is dependent on a conspiracy theory. It's dependent on, you know, there is a massive, complete lack of evidence for any transmission of these beliefs. And the likelihood that they are resurrected at exactly the time that you have clerics in universities who have reason to do this, that suddenly they're being found seems to me much, much, much likelier. But it is an ongoing debate. But I think I think it will come to be seen as equivalent to the idea that there were kind of pagan traditions that were expressed through witchcraft and were resurrected in the late 19th and 20th century, and that modern pagans have anything to do with the ancient pagans, which Ronald Hutton talked about.
He did.
Who is himself a pagan, debunked it. I think it's exactly the same.
It's interesting, isn't it, that Ronald, I still can't get my head around that. The Ronald Hutton basically says modern paganism is a 20th century invention, but then says he is one. Do you not think that's a bit a strange contradiction, Tom?
We should maybe get him back on to talk about that.
Explain yourself, man.
Explain yourself. We'll get a Dominican on the case.
Let's have a couple more Cathar questions. Tony Bang asks a sort of factual question. Is heresy still a thing in Christian countries? So outside Europe, he says, obviously people aren't put to death for heresy within Europe. Well, unless they sort of question the orthodoxy of, I don't know, I mean, not put to death, but you could be cancelled for a kind of heresy, couldn't you?
In Pakistan, for instance, the Ahmadis are definitely persecuted as heretics.
Yeah.
I think there are places, there are places where the Shia are persecuted as heretics.
But not Christian heresy, though, Tom. Christian heresy is no longer a thing, is it?
Yeah. Even in the Church of England, which you'd think was the most herbivorous of churches, there are Anglicans who view, just last week, it was passed at the General Synod that gay couples would be offered blessings. Mm-hmm. And there are people, in the Church of England who view this basically as heresy. I mean, they may not use the word, but they do see it as a heretical development, just as previously they saw the ordination of women priests as basically a heretical development. So yes, I mean, disagreements over doctrine are still very much there. And I think there are conservatives in the Catholic Church, I think, who regard the current Pope as verging on the heretical.
Yeah, there definitely are, aren't there? Talking of the Catholic Church, James Watt VI, who may be Philip Pullman in disguise, says, is the Catholic Church the most dangerous entity in history? I mean, I don't think we can really get into that sort of slightly Ian Paisley-ish territory, but it's fair to say, Tom, isn't it, that there is this, what in Spain they call the black legend, the idea that Spain is peculiarly sinister, superstitious, violent, depraved, all these things. And that legend has also, I mean, that sort of legacy of Protestant anti-Catholicism, that still endures to the present, doesn't it? I mean, don't you see a lot of that in kind of humanist, Pullmanish writing?
Absolutely. So from the late 19th century right the way through to the present day, all the Protestant traditions, all the kind of the accusations, the blackening of Catholicism absolutely has passed into the mainstream of what is basically, I think, kind of godless Protestantism, kind of Richard Dawkins and all
Richard
that kind
Dawkins-ish,
of stuff.
Yeah. We've been watching the TV adaptation of Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials. We're working our way through that. And obviously, the sort of anti-Catholicism, even in the TV version, is quite overt, I think. The sort of halls of the Magisterium and whatnot.
The Magisterium. But the irony is that in a way, I think it's very, it becomes very clear that Philip Pullman, like Richard Dawkins, he's a godless Protestant, but he's in an evangelical tradition. I mean, he's preaching that if you topple idols and you banish superstition, then you will enter the light. You will come into the light, which is basically what the Reformation was all about. And one of the, one of the ironies of it is that Philip Pullman has since been cancelled for being
What's he been cancelled for?
He's been cancelled, I think. Who was it he came to the defence of? Was it Kate Clancy?
Oh,
I
he's
think.
Pro-free speech.
Pro-free speech. Yeah. So he's been cancelled.
That's right.
Way by people who are more radical than him.
Yeah.
On the, this kind of this inheritance of the debate, because the debate about should you be free to say what you want or not is a very traditional Protestant debate.
Yeah. The answer to all this, Tom, is not to have any serious convictions at all, I find.
I think that's much easier.
There's a big discussion on, you've been just talking to people on the Discord about what a historian is. All the big questions, Tom.
So am I a historian? Because I did English.
Oh, because you did English. So you're not a historian, sadly.
So I'm not a historian.
But your answer was that history is a branch of literature. Well, it clearly is a branch of literature, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think it's the only, that's the only discipline of which you could, it could be said, really.
Well, there's a tension within historical writing, I think.
Absolutely, there is.
So at one end, you might have Simon Sharma, but Simon Sharma is thought of, I mean, this will astound probably a lot of listeners. Simon Sharma is thought of disobligingly by some academics because they think he's only interested in kind of purple prose and flowery writing, and he's not interested in the analysis of data and the weighing up of factors.
Because I will freely admit that's not my thing. I'm not into anything that involves data or graphs or anything like that.
Yeah.
And the aspect of history that has always appealed to me is the relationship that historical fact, in inverted commas, has to the texts in which those facts are contained.
Right.
And so that's a very literary perspective.
Yeah.
And I think that that's why I've always written about ancient and early medieval history, where that is much more of an issue. And it's also, I think, why I'm very interested in perspectives on the functioning of history that are shaped by literary texts, of which Christianity and Islam would be the most influential.
There'd be quite a lot of trained sort of historians in academic jobs who would probably agree with you with a lot of that. Certainly when I was studying history, we had to, first of all, when I was studying it, and then when I was teaching at the University of Sheffield, we, in historiography courses, we talked a lot about the idea that history, you're creating literary texts that are themselves based on loads of other texts, and that there is no sort of truth hidden behind that, which a lot of people I know and a lot of listeners to this will find irritating, and they will reject. The others say, oh, it's all just relativism to you. But I think the idea of historical truth is such a chimera anyway.
I think that is why there is, you know, there is a kind of a determination to man the barricades on the part of certain academic historians.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when the kind of the limits of the frontier is under threat, you need to barricade it all the more. And it is an issue for historians that the boundary between academic and literary history can be very contested.
Yeah. Well, history is unusual as an academic discipline. It's the only one where practitioners of that discipline can walk into a sort of high street bookstore and see a lot of very prominent, successful books in their subject being written by outsiders.
Yeah.
Isn't it? There's no other. That doesn't happen if you're studying French literature or if you're studying sociology or...
No.
You know, there aren't sociology books in the top 10.
Maybe perhaps in the field of English.
Not, I mean, used to be, people, but not anymore, actually. Yeah. Not anymore, I would say.
I can't think of any other.
And that means that history is notorious. Jealousy, bitterness, squabbling, turf wars. I mean, yeah. It has been ever since, certainly as long as I can remember.
Well, since Herodotus and Thucydides, Dominic. Thucydides bitching away about Herodotus.
I can remember somebody saying, I think it was actually with regard to somebody like Simon Sharma or David Starkey or someone like that, when I was sort of 20 years ago, somebody saying, the thing about history is there's always, even if you're the dullest, most uncharismatic historian, there is always the very, very slight outside possibility that you might get a TV series. And that's sort of hanging over historians, you know, and the sort of that sense of frustration.
I mean, I cite Herodotus and Thucydides not entirely as a joke, because Thucydides' criticism of Herodotus is precisely that he's too fond of telling stories.
Yeah.
And Thucydides' claim is that he's very, you know, objective, cool, measured, that he's not going to be spiraling off and talking about nonsense things like women or,
right,
you know, any of that kind of nonsense. He's focusing on what really matters. And I think that Thucydides, you know, he is, Herodotus is all about, there are no limits, I can write about anything that I like.
Yeah.
And Thucydides is about, this is real history, this is what counts, this is what matters.
So Thucydides was a gatekeeper.
He was a gatekeeper. Yes, he was a gatekeeper.
Well, I'll tell you two things actually from my own novice days. One is one of my tutors said to me, you have to get out of this habit of writing in a narrative form. You must stop writing narrative. And actually, I did try to stop writing narrative, and then I just thought, sod it. You know, I'll just write narrative, it's more fun. And the other was, somebody once said in my PhD, they said it to me, they said it was too easy to read.
Yeah,
as a criticism.
Fatal crime. Right, one last thing, yes, before we go. So Jack, who is kind of, seems increasingly like Napoleon, he's out to conquer the world.
Jack is the producer of the, he used to be the producer of The Rest Is History, but he's now built his own empire, hasn't he? So he's the producer of lots of podcasts.
Yes. And unlike Alexander, he feels that there are lots of fresh worlds to conquer. And he's been mapping out various places where we might go on a live tour. And among them is Australia and New Zealand.
That's right.
And we were told very sternly, you know, on no account talk about this. Keep it under your hat.
Yeah.
So we've been very, very good not talking about it. And then I woke up a couple of days ago to a message from a friend who's out in Japan, who had obviously been up for several hours. And she said, I gather you're going to Australia. And so I immediately messaged back and said, well, how do you know that? I mean, who's betrayed this secret? She said, I heard it on the BBC, heard it on the radio. So, I mean, I thought, well, I must tell Jack that the secret is out. And so I asked her, you know, where on the BBC? And she gave us this program, The Bottom Line, which is a program about economics and finance. So I rushed off and listened to it. And who was on the program if not Jack?
Yeah.
And he was the one who talked about it. So I think that if he's done it, we can now say that the plan is that we will be going to New Zealand and to Australia for 3 weeks in November, which is obviously, as anyone who lives in England will know, something that is nice to look forward to if you live in England in November.
Yeah, it'll be the summer. It'll be the Antipodean summer, won't it, Tom?
Might be a test match on, Dominic.
Might be. Won't make any difference to me if there is or isn't, Tom, to be honest with you. Yes, so Jack went on The Bottom Line, which is a program about economics, and it was an episode about podcasting. You can probably hear it if you're interested. I actually found it fascinating listening, because they were talking about the podcasting industry, its future, the economics of it. So if you're interested in how the rest is history works, because Jack does talk quite a lot about the rest of his history on that. And he also says, so one of our listeners, MB1872, noted that Jack said on that he was looking to get into publishing. So it's possible that the rest of his history could move into other, you know, there could be other products, as it were.
Although
we're still debating that, though, aren't we, Tom? We're still discussing it. But It's very interesting on how podcasting works, because there's been a lot of stuff in the British media in the last few weeks about whether podcasting's bubble has burst, because far fewer new shows are being produced or being launched than there were a year or two ago, that the industry is kind of consolidating. So will the rest is history survive, Tom? That's the question. I think we'll survive, don't you?
Mm. Well, we've been talking about the Roman Empire and Byzantium. When will the Turks come calling for us?
When will I take the East? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, yes. So Australia and New Zealand, we will keep you posted, of course. I mean, that won't mean a break in the rest of history schedule, will it, Tom?
Of course not.
Never.
No.
Because as we've just shown, we're in the middle of our Columbus marathon. We're recording the next two episodes tomorrow. And far from running out of content, I think we have a bad habit of actually inflating content, I think. So we have Columbus to come. We have Ronald Reagan to come. We have the fall of Saigon. We have Caligula. We have 1650s England. I can't remember what else we have, actually.
Well, I'm just looking it up. We've got 100 Years' War.
Oh, yeah, 100 Years' War.
We've got the Year of the Revolutions. So that's
1848.
Chris Clark has got a new book out on that. We've got, what else have we got? Oh, we've got lots of stuff. It's all coming. Oh, Atlantis. We've got Atlantis.
Atlantis, and you're currently in negotiations with a member of the Habsburg dynasty.
Yes,
I am. To explain the secrets of the Habsburg success.
We'll be talking to the first member of a European royal dynasty to appear on the podcast.
And Theo, you've been taunting Theo with talk of the Library of Alexandria, Tom.
Yeah, we'll do the Library of Alexandria as well. But Dominic snorted at it because the word library featured in it. You did. You poo-pooed it.
I didn't snort at it. I thought I snorted it when you said, I think the Library of Alexandria would be better at attracting first-time listeners than Caligula. And I thought, Caligula.
I didn't exactly say that. I said it. I thought it would... Because I just worry that Caligula is a little bit like Julius Caesar.
The subject of the conversation was how do we bring him? We want to reach small town America.
No, that's immediately how you framed it.
We want to bring in fans of the Kansas City Chiefs to listen to the rest is history. People in bars in small town Missouri. And Tom said, what they pine for there is the Library of Alexandria. That's what all they talk of. In Dayton, Ohio, that people talk of nothing else.
Absolute lie.
And I said lies. We should call it Blood, Sex and Scrolls.
Books for. We will be doing the Library of Alexandria, though. It's going to be good.
This is a penetrating insight into the behind-the-scenes the conversations that we have on the rest of history.
But one of our episodes of Columbus is going to be called Sex and Violence, isn't it?
Is it?
Yeah.
I think they're all going to be called that, Tom, aren't they? Isn't that the point?
Episode 3, with the troubled second voyage. Sex and Violence is what it's all about.
When I started writing for Britain's best-loved newspaper, somebody said to me, you should think of every article as having the headline, The Great Betrayal. and I think of every episode of The Rest is History as being blood, violence, and...
I thought the stereotype of Britain's best-loved newspaper was that it was, why is it going to affect house prices?
Yeah.
Does it give you cancer?
That is the betrayal. Those are the betrayals.
Yes, okay. Yeah, I can see that. All right. Well, I think that's enough.
It is enough.
Been wittering on.
Yeah. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.